menace to the happiness, the peace, and the morality of the public. So he didn't say anything about national security. It was the morality, the peace, and the goodwill.
Good evening. The time is 6:59. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is Calculated Conversations.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland.
Perpetrating but scared to kick reality.
Man, you've been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what time it is.
So what you want me to do?
Spread yourself. Spread yourself. Spread yourself.
Yes, yes, yes. Listeners, welcome back. This is Calculated Conversation for another wonderful Tuesday of Talking This Good Game. I'm David Jefferson. I'm your host, and we got your co-host, Ken Jones, definitely in the house.
Yeah.
Again.
I've made it.
You know, we also got a special guest for you, Jason Jones of the Portland Police Department. 19-year veteran, Jason, am I right?
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we happy to have him in here to kind of, you know, break down some things that he's familiar with and that he's passionate about as far as, you know, his position in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Ken.
So, yeah, right quick for the listeners, this was one of my instructors at Portland State. That's how I first came across. And what piqued my interest as far as Jason was his approach to policing. The class was a comparative criminal justice systems from around the world, so we were kind of delving, and he's been in spaces outside of Portland. He's dealt in different countries and been able to see how they police some of the issues that go on there versus what we have here in the States. And I think the biggest thing that jumped out was just the person. I feel like the person came out in a lot of these slides that he would give us to go with whatever it was our lesson was for the week, and even some of his moments of being conflicted as far as his job duties and so on, from the moral standpoint. And that led me to reaching out, which actually I reached out on some personal stuff to kind of try to see about some things going on in life. And we started going back and forth, let him know about the show, talked a little bit, and thought it would be a great thing to bring him, you know, in here to be able to have some dialogue about what he knows. We hear our side, you know, a lot. And I think that being able to sit at the table and have somebody who's actually connected, somebody who's actually at the ground level, not somewhere, you know, sitting in an office making decisions, but ground level. And for any of the listeners out there, you buy a computer or your phone, you can type him in and see some of the stuff he's done in the community as far as how he has built his career over these last 19 years. And on top of that, the man has a master's degree in behavior science, so I think that also plays a piece into his approach to this whole thing. So enough of my talking. How you doing today, Jason?
Hey, it's been a day. It's been a long day of working on some videos. It's my day off, so my regular duties, patrol. I'm a patrol acting sergeant and in the downtown area, and I've been doing that since January. I'm planning on taking the sergeant's test coming up here, but I've spent the majority of my career in the field doing the work. I've had some opportunities to do some investigative work around domestic violence and things like that, but my heart has always been doing patrol work. Okay. And so the last 6 months has been interesting learning the supervisor role. I didn't think I'd ever do it just because my heart is in the work itself. Right. And I was challenged when somebody said to me, you know, you're being selfish.
Oh.
And I said, what do you mean I'm being selfish? My heart, I'm doing the work in the field. Right. They said, yeah, but you have all this knowledge, but you're not teaching anyone else how to do it. And it's going to die with you when you retire. Right, if you don't take that and start mentoring and sharing that information with other officers and teaching them these things that you've learned along the way. And that really challenged me. And I thought, well, am I being selfish? I thought I was being unselfish by staying in the field and doing the work directly. So I'm giving this a try, and so I'm doing it in the acting role. I have a permanent acting supervisor role until the next test, and so I'm planning on taking the test. I'm enjoying the work, and I see the opportunity to actually work with younger officers and help shape their attitudes and the kind of work that they do.
So that feeling that you have as far as what's connecting you to like the position you're in now, what do you think it is about you that makes that so important?
Well, it's the experiences you have. I mean, first of all, as a police officer, you know, it really depends on how you see the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it comes down to your values, really. It starts there and really your ethics.
Got it.
And so for me, you know, and this is something, I teach ethics at our advanced academy and even down a little bit in Salem at the basic academy. Mm-hmm. Do no harm. And make things better. And I say do no harm, you're thinking, well, sometimes police officers do harm. You know, you see some of these videos out there.
Right.
And so for officers, it's minimize unavoidable harm. You know, also being aware of trauma and the trauma that people feel. Sometimes the uniform and seeing an officer, you become the crisis. You're there. There might be some sort of disturbance going on. Now you show up. For some people, it's made worse.
Right.
So you have to first recognize that and pay attention to how they're reacting to you and tailor your response based on that. And so, for example, if there's a fight going on and somebody is harming another and you've said stop, stop, and they're not stopping, you're going to have to intervene. And it may mean, you know, one of those people that's causing harm, you're going to have to do whatever it takes to get them to stop.
Right.
But you're not going to do any more than you have to. And that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And you want to make situations better. Right. Mm-hmm. You want to treat people fairly. You want to treat people kindly, and you want to be respectful. And when you approach those and use those values into your work and you bring that into your work. And I mean, it's a challenge every day because we're all human beings. We have bad days and things like that. But when you bring that into your work, it makes a difference for other people, and it makes a difference for your coworkers around you, too.
Yes. I think you touched on something like in that word sequence, you know, respectful, being respectful. And this is, you know, something I've had a conversation here recently about. I've had it multiple times, but it's the idea of, we talk about energy a lot on this show, right? And the idea that if you come in with a heightened, your energy's already at a high level.
Yeah.
You're going to be matched. And that's on either side, you know, and that's where, you know, we're all aware of, it's a million videos, you know, out here now that everybody has a recording device where you see an officer pull up and they're already on 10 getting out the car.
Yeah.
And then the energy's matched on the other side, you know, and then vice versa, where, you know, you definitely see it both ways. And, you know, it's just one of those things of how much of just being respectful and how much that goes, how deep that actually goes. And, you know, another thing in which I've ran with is I feel like I'm never going to talk to somebody a way I wouldn't talk to them if I'm a superior. Let's say, you know, I'm a supervisor at my job. I'm not going to talk to my team any way that I wouldn't talk to them on the street, not at work, where I don't have a status above them.
Right.
And that's something, you know, that I feel that's what works. And if that's an approach, it's like, you know, we're here.
Yeah.
And I feel like we would all go a lot further if that was the approach. You know what I mean?
What's interesting is we're now really focusing on crisis intervention and de-escalation, and you mentioned energy.
Right.
And part of that is recognizing the energy and taking some of the energy out of the dynamic, and finding places and ways to do that is really important, because I mean, that's where we see the de-escalation, where we see these things diffuse, and we can actually get people to hear one another.
Righteous.
And really, that a lot of that comes from listening and asking open-ended questions from a place of curiosity and not judgment.
Right.
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 But it's all, you know, body language and tone of voice, and also realizing that respect is earned too.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people have had these traumatic experiences in the past with the police, right, recognizing that and realizing that, you know, it's, you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg,
right,
and so much is below the surface, and just understanding that it's there and being aware of that and asking questions that aren't triggering and that can take some of the energy out and start building the rapport and building respect. And even if that person is not initially respectful, oftentimes you see it start to build, like a little bit of trust. There'll be something they say, and see if there's a reaction.
Yeah.
And when there isn't a negative reaction, it's like, okay, we're actually connecting as human beings.
Right. You know, I think that's a skill, definitely, and I even think it's so much of a skill. And I think about like customer service representatives, right?
Yeah.
The times I've been on the phone outraged about whatever it is, and then I happen to get that person on the other end that is saying the right things at the right pace, to where by the end of this conversation, I feel kind of dumb for even being at that level with them when it had nothing to do with them. And I think there are certain people that have the ability to do that naturally. And then for others, you know, you have to work on it.
You have to learn. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But I think in situations where you have to deal with people, even from, you know, whether it's customer service, whether, you know, it's on the force of the training, being there, because we don't all naturally have it.
Yeah.
And with those, you know, kind of being some of the things at the forefront of just seeing where how important that part of it is, which I'm sure, you know, there's special, you know, positions and roles in which, you know, your crisis team is, you know, different than your average person driving around North Portland or something.
Well, what we're doing there is every officer now gets at least 40 hours of basic crisis intervention training.
Uh-huh.
Every officer in the Portland Police Bureau has that. And then when we identify officers that have that gift, they get an additional 40 hours of training if they choose, if they volunteer, and we call them enhanced crisis intervention team. So those more complicated, serious calls.
Yeah.
Somebody is being violent, that has a weapon, that's suicidal, at a mental health facility, any of those factors plus with a mental health nexus or a mental health component, mm-hmm. those officers go on all of those. Also citizens that say, maybe somebody's called the police, they know that their son who has bipolar disorder or is exhibiting psychotic symptoms, they don't need to explain everything to the dispatcher, and they're tired of that, so they just push the ECIT button. They say, I need an enhanced crisis intervention team member here, and then boom, we send them. And or an officer, you get to a call and you're like, oh, this isn't going to be anything, and it turns into something else. They're like, we need an ECIT officer here.
Yeah.
And so that we have that built in,
mm-hmm.
as well as you mentioned our crisis negotiations team. Those are the people that, you know, television shows are made about, you know, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have that layer too for the ones that require a lot of resources, where you're going to be calling in a SWAT team as well, and different things. But those incidents are rare, few and far between, you know.
Okay, okay.
And our ECIT officers are stealing work from them too, by the way.
So Jason, you know, one thing that I'm a firm believer in is not necessarily everyone, but I think in general society teaches people to be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
I think human nature, you know, again, you know, without the variables, not including the variables of people who are naturally just good-hearted people and understand, like you apparently understand the importance of communication, of being open-minded of energy, especially in your line of work. You understand all these things. We know that it's a lot of officers that don't understand that. And so my personal thing, I've always, when I think about police officers, you know, I think about normal human beings that have a badge. Mm-hmm. And so what that means to me is that they have a little bit more of an opportunity to be human, mm-hmm. with a badge, and pay no consequence for that, for being human.
I see what you mean.
And so my point is, ultimately, when it comes to police officers or humans, we typically do as much as we can get away with. You know what I mean? And being in a position where you can actually get away with a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so we got this test of you know, public responsibility versus your own personal human nature. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking that this might be where the discrepancy in the relationship can be between some of the public and some law enforcement. And I think possibly that's where a lot of the mistrust comes from, because of the amount of power. And we know that all officers don't operate under these conditions and these terms. Some, like yourself, you know, are very, really in tune with the community and society and are trying to, you know, make it a better place and trying to build those community relationships and trying to understand and trying to be non-judgmental. That's not realistic, you know, in the police force at the moment, you know, and a lot of times it hasn't been in our whole historical aspect of law enforcement, you know. And so what do you think, what, like, there's a huge wedge beat, like how do we tighten that gap, you know, like what's it going to take for you think for the community to have more trust, you know. And again, I'm probably more or less speaking of, I'm going to say the inner city community more mm-hmm. than anything, because there's other communities that love you guys' presence. They call you for no reason. You know what I mean? Well, and there's other communities who get anxiety when they even hear your name.
That's right.
When they should be feeling relief. Mm-hmm. And so how can we, why is it like that? How can we bridge this gap? Why does one group of society feel anxiety and one feels relief? Why don't we all feel relief when we think about police officers?
Well, that's a good question. So first of all, I would start way back when, and there's already this natural distrust for government. Mm-hmm. It's built into our history as a country and into our constitution, right? We already have this adversarial belief about, you know, the people and limiting the power of government. Mm-hmm. That's there from the very beginning. Right. And since we're talking about history, obviously, and I mean, I think probably every listener here is aware of the history of how police have been used mm-hmm. as an instrument of the government and governmental practices that oppress certain groups of people.
That's right.
Right? And being aware of that history, that has a legacy, and that has ripples through time mm-hmm. that people tell stories to their children mm-hmm. and people see things on now in social media that's everywhere and say, see, that's still going on today. Right. And that could be in New York or New Jersey or somewhere else. Right. But if you're living in Portland, Oregon, that person with a badge somewhere else, it's like it happened here. It easily could right. be like it happened here. So we're fighting a lot of forces, right? A lot of things that we're having to go against the tide and against the currents. Right. But you're asking me for a real solution, and I'm gonna give you a real solution and not just lip service.
Okay, great.
Here's my belief. Here's the thing that I preach and I will until I leave this field and probably beyond that. If you look at the research about medical doctors who work in ERs, emergency rooms, I really compare what doctors do in that work of triaging injuries and working with patients in that setting to what police officers are doing in responding to 911 calls. Mm-hmm. And what we found is doctors are humans like police officers. They make mistakes, mm-hmm. right? Some of them are life mistakes. And in fact, if you look at how many people die because of medical negligence, mm-hmm. and you look at the people that are actually dying in communities of color, people who are poor, elderly, right? Mm-hmm. It's staggering. But we don't see a lot of that data because some of that's HIPAA protected, right? Well, what the doctors have figured out and the medical community has figured out is that if you create a follow-up and follow-through culture, that if you spend mm-hmm. a little more time with your patient, and not only that, you don't just stitch them up and kick them out the door, but you follow up with a phone call and say, hey, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to think about somebody that just, you know, stitched you up and kicked you out, and you know they're busy, but they took the time a few days later to call you just to check in? You're going to think that person cares. That person's a good person. Wow, this is my doctor. I don't want to sue my doctor, right? This guy, even if he did make a mistake or she, they care. And so it's true with officers. I believe that instead of just going to a 911 call and dealing with whatever and dealing and moving on, we need to spend a little more time with the person, connecting as human beings, mm-hmm. right? Giving them something, even though probably we're not going to be able to solve that crime. Mm-hmm. A lot of our burglaries and property crimes have a really low solve rate,
right?
And even some of our violent crime, especially if we can't identify the offender and things like that, we're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
So spending a little, as human beings, connecting, I'm sorry that happened. Sir, I'm sorry that happened, ma'am. And within a week, calling the person or visiting the person and saying, you know what, I just want to check in and see how you're doing.
Right. Right.
You're going to think, wow, this police officer cares. He's a guardian. He's not an oppressor. This person is somebody that is here for me and serving.
Right.
We're not no longer calling the police force a police force, but rather a police service. Right? It's just protect and serve, seeing people as guardians rather than an occupying army. And we need to keep doing that kind of work. I mean, we can continue running football camps and things like that and going and putting stuff up on Twitter and Facebook and doing stuff. But we need to do more than that in the community where it's real, where the pain is. And we see the suffering and the human misery and the trauma on these calls.
Right.
Because that's where people, that's what people want police and need police, and I think we could do a little bit more there.
Is that how does something like that even get enacted? Like, do you guys develop a proposal, you go to a superior, like how can it actually be realistic?
We could create a policy, right? And people, there's so many policies. If you saw our training and our policy, we're saturated, right?
Yeah.
It's got to come from within. It's something that as officers, we recognize that we do, and it becomes an expectation. And there's a lot of resistance.
It's a personal officer.
Oh, it has to start there.
Yeah.
And we have to believe, we have to get them when they're younger, mm-hmm. and they're coming out going, all right, this is just something that I do.
Yeah.
Because officers retire. I mean, we're going to have probably in the next 2 years, 100 to 150 officers retire. That's 10 to 15% of our police service.
Jeez.
They're going to be gone. But who's coming in?
Right.
100 to 150 new people that we're now recruiting in different places than we've ever recruited before,
mm-hmm.
in communities of color. We're trying to bring more women in so we're more balanced gender-wise, right? As
mm-hmm.
well as demographically, we're trying to better represent the communities. Mm-hmm. But then we're also going to the School of Social Work and not just going to the School of Criminal Justice, the School of Sociology and Psychology, the people that understand what trauma is all about.
Right.
You have people that understand what trauma is all about, and they're going to understand the need for a follow-up and follow-through culture, right?
Yeah, and so what I'm getting from that is kind of rooted in the idea that it is teaching the youngs. Essentially, you know, it's the new guys, the new fresh. It's in changing the culture from there,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think, like, even in our system of government and everything else, we've got people who have been in these positions for a very long time, and they came in when the social norms were at a certain place, and it was okay for a lot of things. And so, you know, as the years go by, they're holding on. They're the decision makers, you know, when
mm-hmm.
it boils down to it. And when these new people come in that have a more open mind and they're more receptive to actually being connected to what's going on, that's typically when we see some type of change happen.
Yeah.
And what I guess too in there is thinking as far as the force and that idea of needing this culture change. So let's say they're coming in and they're being trained, right? And it's somebody that's teaching them the right things. Once they get in the field and they're paired with whoever they're paired with, do you think that will undo?
Well, it can, but the interesting thing is you're only paired with somebody for a limited time, and you're going to be paired with five or six people throughout your training period.
Okay.
And so just like teachers or doctors or any field, you're going to have good field training officers and ones that you don't think are that good. But what I've noticed is there's a lot of younger officers wanting to be coaches or field training officers now. So I'm seeing people that I did a brief stint in personnel back in 2000 and 2010 through 2012, the psychology, right? Yeah. Learning about people and why they want to do this job and hiring the right people. And it was very fascinating for me from a behavioral science perspective. Right. But some of those people now are coaches, and they've only been officers 5 or 6 years, and they're now teaching the brand new ones. Yeah. And you can imagine, I mean, and I've had some of them in the academy, and I know how they think.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm seeing the culture change from within, and I think that's a much more powerful way to change from the in-group, from the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, I've told social work students this, you know, they say, well, we don't necessarily like the way the police do business. Well, come become one of us and change that from the inside. Mm. You can try to do it from the outside, but, you know, there's resistance there. You know, if somebody has never had that experience, that's like coming to you and telling you that you need to change this and you need to change that when they've never been you. They've never walked in your shoes.
It's just,
you're going to be like, what are you talking about? Right. There's going to be some defensiveness there because they're not you.
Right.
And so you got to become a part of that culture to change it.
See, you did mention too that, you know, with this, these people that are be coming in, this, you know, up to 150 people, widening the demographic, also more women. In your opinion, do you feel that, in these communities, like, you know, a predominantly black community, do you think that there should be more officers from that type of background policing that type of community? Do you think that would be something to help bridge some of those?
Well, it can, but it also isn't always that way. I've seen some African-American officers that are working in their community, and then they're called names. They're called awful names by members of they're and then it's like, you know, some of them say, I don't want to work in that neighborhood because or they know some of the people and it's awkward, and it's like
conflict of interest.
It's almost like it's a conflict. It's like why a judge would recuse themselves in a case, right? And so they can't be objective because of family ties, so they're going to work in another neighborhood where they can be objective, and they're also not going to be called awful names. But it is helpful having a lot of different officers from different backgrounds, and then those officers get to choose where they work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I tend to think that a lot of times, you know, there's a huge, I think, division between the effectiveness of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times you guys get the brunt. I mean, it's almost kind of like, I mean, it could almost be coupled or parallel with something like prejudice or racial discrimination, because you guys, good officers, catch the brunt of a lot of things that bad officers do, just like some African-Americans catch the brunt of what some African-Americans do.
Right.
And we all get judged the same.
Right.
So that's got to be tough for an officer trying to do his job and trying to actually build a community as opposed to breaking it down. So my question, I got kind of a big question. I think it's big. Police accountability, you know, like, I think one of the reasons why a part of the public is mistrusting of law enforcement is because they're rarely ever held fully accountable for when they are in misconduct. I guess if that's been proven, I don't know, videotape, what, maybe not, but so. And then, you know, and then there are a lot of the public believes that most officers are good. And so my question is, can an officer still be considered a good officer if he's not holding his peers accountable for things that maybe the public has not seen? Maybe he's his partner riding around, he sees misconduct. Is it his responsibility to bring that to light, to bring that to the precinct, to bring that to the superiors? Or is there some type of police code where you think he should be like, well, you know, we're on the same team, so I don't have to really hold you accountable like I do the public?
That's so basically you're talking about a double standard.
That's
and
right.
So what's interesting is, there's a lot of how do I say this? There's like movies that still portray this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this is kind of outdated thinking. I know that personally, and having seen it and been involved in some things, when we see bad behavior in Portland, Oregon, I can't speak for New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, or some other city somewhere else, but that does not happen like it has in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I also know some folks that have retired and are I talk to him for the stories. I want the stories, right? What happened in the 60s in the Portland Police Bureau, in the 70s, in the 80s. Yeah. And I'm shocked at some of the things that I've heard. Shocked. Mm-hmm. But I record those for my ethics class, and I bring these up to officers as we talk about corruption. And I say, do you think this has ever happened in Portland, Oregon? And a lot of them said, nope. And I said, it absolutely has. And this is when it happened, and this was the background behind it, to teach them about what is still possible. Because in their experience, they're like, oh, no, that doesn't happen anymore.
Right, exactly.
Okay, we're human beings, and history has a strange way of echoing or repeating itself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so by inoculating them to that, my hope is that they won't ever tolerate that kind of behavior. That said, understanding human behavior, there's this thing called traumatic bonding out there, right?
Yeah.
Where if you have such trust and such loyalty built up that you know this person would protect you mm-hmm. in any given situation, and they got your back, and then there's that conflict there. Wow, they just did this, but yet I have this traumatic bond with them. We were through these awful things. We've gone through all this stuff together, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to decouple that, and especially an officer's mind, and really, that's not loyalty. Mm-hmm. Loyalty is supporting somebody through a process, but holding them accountable. So mm-hmm. if they do something wrong, you say, you know what? You did this thing you shouldn't have done. I'm going to be with you through the process of holding you accountable. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you don't want that, that's, you know, because you blame me for bringing this to light. But yeah. It's like this. You did this thing wrong. Let's go in. Let's go tell somebody. I'll be there with you through the process. You bring it to light.
Mm-hmm.
You have honor in this situation, you know, whether it be a mistake or intentional,
you'll give him the accountability of admitting.
Yeah, yeah. You want to give him,
but you'll be with him every. But
yeah, that's loyalty, right? That's walking with somebody, right? But you're not giving them a free pass to do bad behavior. You know, my children, that's something that I have passed on to them. It's like, you know what? You did this wrong thing. You need to admit it. I love you. I'll nothing will change. I'm going to walk with you through this. I'm going to advocate for you. But there's accountability that needs to happen here.
And in the instance that they decide that's not the route they want to take,
then you have to go up and you have to say, listen, you know what I have to do. I'd rather you do it than me do it.
And do you believe that there are officers in the field that don't do that?
Of course. It's human nature. It's in any field, right? I mean, of course, not everybody does that.
Yeah.
You know, I believe, this is my belief in just looking at big numbers, you have 10% of officers that are just your superstars. They're just out there and they don't even need supervision or you know, you don't even need those kind of structures for them. And then you have 80% of the officers that, you know, they're just kind of in the middle. They're doing the job. They're kind of more quiet. They're doing the work, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the small percentage of the ones causing the problems,
right?
They're the ones that need to be weeded out. They're the ones that need correction and discipline,
right?
Because they're the ones that are intentionally doing harm or are just, they're just, they slip through the cracks, or they've experienced some trauma in this work. And by the way, there's a lot of untreated trauma for police out there that
right.
you don't even think about. You think about the bad thing that happened to you this one time. Now officers do that every day and sometimes multiple times a day. And there's not a lot of help and support for officers. So I'm not justifying, mm-hmm. I'm just explaining why bad behavior sometimes happens, mm-hmm. or at least I've seen, and why officers' careers self-destruct.
Right.
So.
Do you think that some of the because I feel like just the some of the divisions in the country, just I think the media's influence too, of this constant pump and dump of information and
right.
and content, of just, does that affect any of the internal?
Oh yeah, it hurts. It hurts me. It hurts my heart. I gotta tell mm-hmm. you, makes me sad when I see something bad happen out there. I feel bad for the family, but then I feel bad for anyone that's scared already mm-hmm. or has these, because it's gonna make every officer's job that much harder when they go on calls.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I mean, the answer is, I mean, it's almost like a fire hydrant of information. You can't drink all of it, right? But, you know, if you kind of focus on what you have control over, and mm-hmm. for me, that's my attitude, like how I project, right. my effort, like what I do and how I treat people. And I focus on that. And then I try to build relationships so that you know me, and you're like, you know what? That, you know, I'm mad at police right now. I saw this thing and I'm just mad at police
right
now.
Right.
But I know this one cop, Jason, he's a cool guy, right? That's a start. Right. And then you'd be like, you know what? I'm going to go reach out to Jason and see what he thinks about this and get his thoughts. Right. And then I'm going to process with him a little bit about this.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, I'm level again. And I realize that was an incident that happened here or there or wherever. Mm. And it's not everyone. And it's not a whole group. It's that incident. I don't know.
So I got to, because one of the things that I know that you do, and which is interact, right? And is that something that's taught as far as where the training is at now? Is that something that's told to cops as far as when you're in these, you know, these neighborhoods to say what's up to the group of kids over here? To, you know, the waves, the simple interaction to where it's not just, you know, focus, I'm looking at my computer, I'm trying to figure out what's going on, you know, because there's some people...
The basketball
look—the
basketball cards I used to give out.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right. What happened? Yeah. Right. You know? But it's those. Is that stuff still, you know, a focus as far as the training for the people who come in? And just again, it's not like I'm in these streets like that at this point. But I feel like I don't see so much foot patrol. I don't see the cops walking through the park. You know, none of these pieces that I feel like growing up, there was a lot of images of that of a car parked and people on foot.
Yeah, well, good point. So I'll tell you, we used to call it community policing, and we still use that term, but that's such a nebulous, abstract term. Okay. I mean, I teach a class on it, so I could describe it, and I won't bore you with it. But now we're being more focused and targeted. We're calling it community engagement, those opportunities where we're able to connect with people in the community, whether it be foot patrol or whether it be a playing basketball or at a park or being part of a tournament, wrestling tournament. Mm-hmm. There's little things. We find these opportunities, but then it's like, how do we message that so that people see it? But how do we message it in a way where people are like, look, they're just trying to pose here for another, like, get another check on the community side. So it's a careful balance.
Yeah.
But you're right, there aren't as many foot patrols because per capita now, Portland is one of the least police cities our size. Mm. Quite honestly, we've grown by over the size of the city of Salem, and we've shrunk as a department by the whole entire Salem Police Department. So if you look per capita of what our rate is, about 1.5 per thousand.
Yeah.
Other places it's 3.5 and up to 6. Mm. And so we're
they
low.
In Beaverton.
Yeah, right. Well, so what's interesting is we try to get out and do some foot patrol in like hot spots, areas where crime is concentrating, to get out and talk to people and also just be there so that we can maybe prevent crime. Mm-hmm. People will be, oh, cops, they're walking. But also that we're able to just talk to people, well, hey, what's going on, and things like that. But it's very targeted because the rest of our cops are investigating serious crimes or flying to the 911 calls.
Right.
Makes it hard, but not impossible, to do the follow-up, follow-through thing. I still believe we can do that.
Yeah.
It's just right now it's a challenging environment. But back to your point about how do we teach that? You can't teach that in an academy, right?
Okay.
Like, go meet with kids, and we're going to have a class on that and a test on that. You can't really do it. So we're trying to hire more people like that, and then that's something where if you have enough officers out there that do it, they're going to show mm-hmm. the new ones, hey, this is what we do.
Right.
Do you think it has any effect, like, because didn't it go from at one point you had to have your bachelor's and then it dropped down?
Right.
So, like, for instance, with you and, you know, what you have in the master's in behavioral science, I feel like that gives you a certain advantage. And do you think some of the culture could possibly change, being that you accepted people with a certain type of schooling?
Mm-hmm.
And having that at a certain level, do you think that would possibly open up because they've been, you know, spent years in school focusing on these very things we're having a conversation with at this table, where it's a focus in that, as opposed to, and what are the requirements at this point? Is it
it's like a basically a 2-year degree or military or some reserve time or cadet time. We're trying to open up. So the reason why we lowered it is because we just didn't have the applicant pool.
Got it.
And when you're trying to draw in a diverse demographic,
you
might not get people that have had that 4-year degree.
Yeah.
And if there's certain, like, say you're wanting more African American men to do the job. Well, so we're now, if we're saying bachelor's degree, we're excluding many.
Uh-huh.
And then the ones that have it, they're in high demand. There's going to be a lot of like all the law enforcement agencies, corrections, businesses, right? Because they're all trying to be so-called, quote, more diverse,
right?
So it's like we need to open this up and then have some education incentives once you get here to get your bachelor's degree, to go on and get more education. And so that's why we do it. And we have multiple pathways, whether it be military, whether it be, hey, you did some time as a reserve and you just don't want to go to college, okay. Or you were a cadet for a while, or you got 2 years of college, great, when whatever you got it in. And we don't want to really limit it, because somebody might get their degree in philosophy, right? And so they're going to be maybe focused on ethics and things. Maybe somebody over here psychology, maybe someone over here engineering, computer science, math. All of those people have a place,
believe
it or not, because you have these complex investigations with like car crashes and speed and physics and these complicated math formulas. I'm going to leave that to somebody that went to school for that. That's not my thing, right? Specialization.
Right. So do you think, though, with that, because I get that, breaking that down like that, got it, but what, maybe even going back, I guess everything finds its way back to training. It's like everything that I can think of kind of comes back to that. Mm-hmm. And wondering if, you know, things were set up, and I don't know how rigorous the process is, so I can't speak on, but the idea that thinking of, you know, going down a path of one of the social sciences, this is kind of a rigorous path, like, and may not be bunched in of sit down 4 years, do this, but a continued where you're almost breaking it down, where it's almost the equivalent of having to go through these, you know, this process where it's not just a one time, you know, 40-hour, 80-hour thing, but one of these reoccurring things, so the stuff stays current because things change.
Well, we do that. We have an annual in-service training. Okay. So we get like a week a year, and then officers get additional training that is optional, like you can put in for, based on what your interests are. So if I make you take a class, something that you're not interested in, you hate, you're going to do what you got to do, and you're going to get through it, and you're going to be done, right?
Yeah.
But if I give you an option, say this is, and you're like, I really want to take that class, I'm really excited to learn that stuff, you're going to be all over it, and you're gonna read more about it, you're going to go above and beyond. So we also try to, while there's that basic, hey, we're all going through these classes, and whether it be implicit bias or a crisis intervention update class or a legal update class, or we're going to learn about bloodborne pathogens, or we're gonna get our time in patrol tactics and working through some different scenarios, or driving, hey, let's work on our driving, we got to go through a cone course backwards, and things like, you know, all these things that you do. There is ongoing continued training that's usually about a week a year, and then there's additional training that officers can do based on what they want to do. I mean, some officers are just interested in different things, and I think that's the cool thing about policing is, you know, if you're interested in underwater basket weaving, if you could build that into a, like, maybe you're going to teach a class with young people about underwater basket weaving, great, you can do that, right? Or, like, hiking. Like, I love to hike, so what did I do? For our youth camp in the summer, guess what I did? Hiking camp, right? And you know what I found is there's some kids that can't be in structured sports activities all day. They just don't. They're just not wired that way, and they're getting in trouble. And their behavior. They're all these behavior. We're kicking them out of camp. I'm like, these are at-risk kids.
Right.
You don't want to kick an at-risk kid out of camp,
right?
You don't want them to have those bad interactions. So let's create more activities. So we have martial arts. We have science camp, journalism camp. There's more, and then I put together hiking for those young people, where I just have a couple basic rules: don't harm the plants and stuff. But if you want to swing a stick or throw a rock, jump in a creek, have fun,
right?
And we're going to do different hikes every day, and you're going to see things, and we're going to bring people in who are going to talk a little bit about nature so you can learn about the world around you and how delicate it is.
Right quick, for the listeners, we realize we got about 20 minutes left, 18 minutes. The phone number up here, 503-231-8187. If you have something you want to chime in, make sure to dial that phone number. Again, 503-231-8187.
I got a question for you. You heard about, I'm sure you probably, you know, was aware of like a lot of the police, you know, involved killings around the country within the last few years.
I studied it for class criminology, but also it's just something that I'm very aware of. Yeah, okay. Of course.
You saw the videos. You saw a majority of videos. Did you see any where you felt like there was any police misconduct, or maybe you thought the officer overreacted?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of them where you go, you know. So first of all, we're it's kind of like this. If you have your group of whatever that might be, your friends, your neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. Internally, you're going to be harder on your friends. But if outside people attack your friends, you're going to be like Papa Bear. You're going to be really defensive, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some of that. So we look internally as a police officer. I'll look at a video, and some of it is I'm going to say, well, I realize that that's one angle. Right. We need to see if there's other cameras. Right. We need to see what other information comes out. So we're kind of trained to go, all right, I gotta as bad as that looks, I need to I need to wait a minute.
I need
right?
more information.
I need more. And though unfortunately in our society that's not how it works. You see the video and people just the judgment's there, and nobody knows 6 months later any of this other thing because it's on the back page of the paper. Nobody right. cares. But that's what they remember is that initial thing they saw. And then they see another one of those and another one of those. But absolutely, I've seen plenty of videos where I go, it breaks my heart to see. And it also, I look at the training. And here's the other thing. Training across the country for police, vastly different yeah. across this country. We are not a homogenized discipline or field. Vastly different what you pay officers. We're well paid out here. You go to other places, they're making like $13, $14 an hour. Now you get what you pay for. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, I totally hear you, and I agree with what you just said. I absolutely, I see these things, some of these things from across the country, and I'm like, oh my goodness.
You know, and when I think about those things, I mean, there's always more information, you know, to be examined, but from the ones that's kind of clear, plain as day, a lot of times they never get charged, and mm-hmm. and more often than not, even if they do, there's really no conviction. Mm-hmm. I think the public is losing a lot of trust yeah. at that point. You know, like I really do believe if there was more charges and some actual convictions, I think that community and police relationship would be a little bit stronger. A little bit, yeah. you know what I mean? But without that happening, it's just like it almost looks like a free for all on the community and with no judgments, you know, by the government, you know, no accountability. I mean, that's a lot of power, and that scares the heck out of the public.
Yeah, no, I agree. And what's interesting is I'll give you just a police officer perspective on it. Sometimes we see DAs that will indict without all the facts were based just on an initial public opinion. Mm-hmm. And that scares officers because it's like, okay, so if I'm going out doing my job, right? And say it just looks bad, is the process going to be fair?
Right.
Or is this going to be a situation where everyone's rushing to judgment and I'm going to be condemned before I have a process? So, you know, there's got to be a careful balance there, and I don't know what the final answer is, but I agree there's got to be accountability for police. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we how do I say this, if we make it too tough, or if we take it one direction too far, officers aren't going to be willing to do much. You know, that's going to be, you'll see a demoralized police force, because they'll be like, wow, I could be indicted, I'm doing a job where I could end up in prison.
Right.
That would be a scary proposition. Right. Especially, right. I mean, imagine a police officer in prison. Right. Right? You got to be in administrative segregation.
And I think that's probably where, you know, the extensive concern and training and education would come in place. Yeah. Because then you would actually, I don't know, I just think the training would be a little bit more designed to have more intelligent, educated, you know, more.
Yeah, no, and you know what? I would love for you to be able to go, and I tell your listeners, try a Citizens Academy. Go to a Citizens Police Academy, mm-hmm. so you get to actually see what police training's like,
yeah.
and you're like, whoa. I mean, it's very different than what...
than what we think?
Yeah, yeah.
I think, too, just something to kind of throw in the mix is the idea, and I think about this often, in these scenarios when they pop up. Like, I don't even watch the videos anymore. The last video I watched it wasn't even a black dude, it was a white dude that got killed in a hotel floor. And watching him be scared, and this is what it brought up for me, is like, he was frightened, and this officer's yelling these commands, and he's confused. Like, yeah. you can clearly see he's confused. And it's like, that's the piece that kind of gets me sometimes, is the idea that as a regular civilian, I'm supposed to be able to take all of this and act accordingly. And when I don't, you know, on the other side, what we see is, based on the media, what comes out in these cases is a cop fearing for his life, a cop feeling this way, this way. But as far as a civilian, we're kind of supposed to know what it's like to have guns pointed at us, or be, you know, being in these situations that are actually high pressure, high stress. And it's like, that can be confusing.
Of course.
Some people don't even know how to handle just a conflict in Safeway checkout line, you know, so imagine being in these situations. And I just, you know, see some of that. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about, the idea of, you know, the more accountability, because we don't see anybody on that end. I don't know, because I don't know the statistics on, you know, as far as the conviction rate and so on, so I won't ride that. But the idea that if I think there's a idea that in the culture, if I know I can walk around here like a bully, right, in a school, right, and I know that, let's say my parent is one of the principal, and he's gonna look out for me, so I can kind of go here and just slap people in the back of their head, and there's really not going to be any repercussion. And after a minute of knowing this, and then, you know, a couple of my friends kind of getting away with the same thing, and it's this idea that I might get yelled at up front, but in the back end, nothing's really going. And I think that, you know, also power is a crazy thing. And I think that there's definitely people that come in with the right intentions, like anything else, come in with the right intentions, and they take that, and it can go to the head of like, oh, I can do this, and there's really no kickback, you know, and that just, that piece just gets me, and that's what tears me up, in that idea of the fear, and on both sides sometimes, you know, it's not just one side, and you have two fearful people, that's the worst thing in the world.
Right, you know? We know you guys got the side too, man.
No, I appreciate that, I totally hear what you're saying, I absolutely do.
We better bring Jeff on the line, man.
Come on, Jeff, where you been at? Come on, Nick.
Sorry, Jeff.
Call back.
Nick, you in there? Nothing? Well, if you out there, Nick, call back in. We had a little difficulty in the back end.
Sorry, Nick. I apologize. You too.
But we do know it's always two sides. And again, this show is calculated conversation, because these conversations are important. They just have to take place. And a big part of society, and especially even outside of community police relations, is just the fact that most people really don't know what other people go through. And so you coming in on the outside trying to figure something out with a person who you don't even know who they are, how they feel, what they've been through, experience, and then they don't know the same thing with you. So we all here trying to figure out how can we lighten the interaction, you know. And again, it's not just about you know, community and police, it's just the world overall. But you're just in an important position in the community, and so that's pretty.
It's a position of privilege and power, right? And so recognizing that and wearing that in a way that's not, hey, I, you know, look at me, I have this, but rather it's a responsibility. It's a huge responsibility. It's a big weight too. And you think about it, and you think about, you know, people's lives, I could potentially be responsible for. And if I make the wrong decision, I'm gonna have to live with that for the rest of my life, and that's gonna affect my relationships at home and with my friends, and whether I even stay in this line of work, or if I become more withdrawn or reserved or hesitant because of this poor decision that I made, this mistake or whatever it might be, right? I mean, you can't have a bad day in this job. If you have a bad day in this job, it could cost you your job, or it could cost you a lot of other things, or somebody else's, you know, or affect them in such a bad way that, I mean, now they're traumatized, and you and now their life is going to be damaged as a result of your mistake or your bad action, right? I mean, that's heavy. That's let me tell you, on the shoulder.
Jeff, you online? Can we bring Jeff in?
Hello.
Hello.
You're on air, Jeff.
Hey. Man, thanks for taking my call. Officer Jason, I had a couple of quick questions, if you'll permit me. You've been an officer on our force now for 19 years, so you've seen many different police chiefs. First of all, how has Chief Outlaw been for the force? And secondly, you also serve a second master, which is the police union, the president of whom made a big splash in the media recently. And finally, will August 10th's National Night Out be a real opportunity for officers across our force to communicate directly with the people? I'll take my answers off the air, and thanks for taking my call.
So I missed part of that, but I caught how is, you know, we've had different police chiefs, and certainly Portland's had several, and now we have Chief Outlaw. You know, quite honestly, I've only seen her a couple times. I haven't actually met her, but I've watched how she's making changes. And what's interesting is she's bringing in people. She spent some time and sat back and watched and looked around, mm-hmm. which before just making immediate changes. She didn't try to make Portland Oakland, right? Mm-hmm. She went, okay, what's going on here? Right. I need to meet some people.
Yeah.
And she brought some people onto her team that I really respect and I'm friends with, that I know. And that was a big impression. She came in and identified them right out of the bed. These are people that I want to help me and shape what I'm seeing here in Portland.
Yeah.
And then she sat back and she started developing relationships, and she listened, and she did her job, but mm-hmm. she wasn't making big changes yet because she didn't know what needed to be changed. Now she's owning it.
Yeah.
She's brought in new assistant chiefs, a deputy chief, and promoting people that she wants, the values that she believes and the changes that she wants to bring. So
great.
She's bringing people up, right? So that's impressive. Even though I don't know her well enough yet, I mean, I'm sure I'm going to have an opportunity. There's 1,000 of us in one of her, right?
Right.
So
you
got to recognize that. She's got a lot to do. I mean, she's got a big organization to run. So I've been watching from afar, and that's been fun for me. And I'm really impressed with what I'm seeing. But as far as serving the master, as far as a police union, actually, they serve me. I vote, right? I'm a voting member of the Portland Police Association. They don't tell me what to say or what not to say.
Okay.
They don't know I'm here, and you know, and they could probably care less.
Right.
But so I get to vote on my union president. We get to vote on these issues. We have a voice at the table. Sometimes it's adversarial with the city, but not always. Oftentimes it's, we're trying to reach consensus on things, which makes sense. And so they're representing the rank and file officer. And so I know that sometimes the union gets a bad rap, but I'm glad we have the Portland Police Association. And I appreciate what they do. And I really like Daryl Turner. I know him well. And several of the e-board, our board that are elected to make some of the other decisions that mm-hmm. the rank, and we can't make every decision. We have a Republican form of governance there too, where we have, you know, elected people that make the decisions. But on the bigger ones, we're out there. I just dropped something, everybody. I did that. I made that mistake.
Hey, one question before we got to go. You know who Barbecue Becky is?
I'm trying to think that name. No, I don't know. Who is that?
It was a lady out in Oakland, California at the park, and she called the police on a black family that was barbecuing with charcoal. And there's Permit Patty, too. But Barbecue Becky, she was popular.
Oh, wow.
She got it popping. But anyway, so those kind of calls, man. Like
I love it.
You love those?
Yeah, absolutely. I want some hard questions. I want some, like, ask me some really, like, personal hard questions.
Oh.
No, we didn't have time. That's why I was going out with the funny one.
Yeah.
No, but anyways.
We got to bring a part two.
Man, I would love that.
So, one quick thing. We got a minute left here. If you could give some advice to yourself before entering the force, what would that be?
Ooh, that's a deep question. I mean, you don't know what you're getting into. I will tell you that. Like, I had no idea. I'm like, I thought I knew, right? I'm like, oh no, I know what I'm getting myself into.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And I mean, there was a lot of trauma in the first couple of years, and I had to work through that trauma. And then I didn't know if I was even going to stay in this business.
Right.
And I worked through it. I read, I talked to people, I processed, I found mentors, and I found my place and I found my stride. But it wasn't just police mentors, it was people in the community too.
Mm.
And there was one particular minister in Inner North Portland that took me under his wing and was very patient with me and helped me in the community too. So I didn't go to his church. I just met him out on patrol, and he just we would meet, and I owe him a lot.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's dope. Well, we appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks for coming, Jason. We appreciate it.
Yes.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank y'all for listening. See you next Tuesday.
Check us out on all the platforms, calculatedconversation.com.
Stacking kicks. Stacking kicks.
Walk this way. Forward. Coming soon.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and
Girl in the cut of sheet shoes, take, like, going.